Hey everybody, it's been a 007 here. Just a little bit confusingly, as is the want of feast dance, there will be a lot of chat in this reread episode about how we at Vassals of Kingsgrave are not going to do a wrap-up episode for A Feast for Crows. However, we are. We decided after that to do one. So even though we're now all dance all of the time, the next episode of this reread, episode 90, will in fact be a feast wrap-up. So stay tuned for that. Here's the show. Hey everybody, and welcome to the Vassals of Kingsgrave's Great Linear Song of Ice and Fire reread. My name's Bina 007, and I'm going to be your host for the 89th episode of this podcast series. You might have been expecting a summary of the events of A Feast for Crows as episode 89, hosted by Sarah Lady Weaver. But it turned out that for various reasons, there wasn't much interest in doing that. And at the end of this episode, we've got a little after show with myself, Sarah, and Adam Drowned Snow talking about why that maybe is. But fear not, if you want your Sansa love and summary and Arianne and all those other feast characters that are with us no more, we will be summarizing that at the end of Feast Dance. Okie dokie. As I said, my name's Bina. I'm joined today by a very hungover Queen James.
Hello, everybody.
By a less hungover and yet sleep-deprived Matt.
Hey, blue armor on the forums.
Apparently by a hale and healthy Michael.
Yeah, what's up? Calibur Deggy is 100% ready to go.
By Pops 88, Noah, what kind of state are you in today?
Lounging on my bed with a beer.
Living the life. we're also joined by the man who started this podcast series off, Brett.
I didn't start it, you started it, you liar.
You're the first voice heard on the series, dude.
I don't think so.
You really are. Dragons live on the moon. That's literally the first sentence of the series.
No, it wasn't.
Perfect.
How's it going, White Raven?
Great. How are you?
Very well, very well. Is Jock on the line? Do we have Jock with us? He maybe will join and lurk later. And preventing this from being a complete sausage fest, we have hopefully Mary.
Hey, yeah, I'm here. Maybe staying, maybe not. We'll see. And I'm neither sleep deprived nor hangover. So here we go.
There you go. Continental
Bina,
Europe.
You were a sausage.
Continental Europe for the win. Don't define me, Brett. We live in a fluid world. Okie dokie. Right, so today we are getting into All Dance All of the Time. In episode 88, we finished our last chapter in Feast with Sam in Oldtown, meeting Pate on May 21st. In this episode, we're going to cover Danny 6, Jamie 1, and Aerio 1, aka the Watcher from Dance. I kind of felt a bit sad, actually. I finished reading the Feast chapters a couple days ago, and I put that book back on the shelf, and it was kind of like, oh. These events take place between May 22nd and May 28th, 300 AL, finally finishing the events of May 300. So before we get into the chapters, there were 20 chapters in May. Brienne met Kat, Jamie threatened Edmure's baby with a trebuchet, rejected Cersei's plea for help, Arya regained her sight, Sansa left the Eyrie. Theon regained his identity, Brienne and Jaime were reunited, Dany and Daario were reunited too, and Gregor's head was returned to Dawn. So, you know, a fuck ton happened. Just to make you potentially very depressed, this time last year in reread order, in May 299, we were still in A Clash of Kings, and the events of the month were covered in just six chapters and included the Battle of Oxcross and the Siege of Storm's End. Renly was alive. Guys, is this the most densely plotted series that you've ever read? Because some of you read a lot more fantasy. Is this normal to take a year for this much stuff? I don't know.
Oh. I don't know, because it's also, I read a lot of fantasy, but I don't usually have a full timeline of what is going on when. So I think it's quite normal, but maybe a bit more than normal.
Yeah. It was the fact that Renly was still alive that shocked me.
Yeah, it seems like forever ago.
Sorry, Matt.
Yeah, no, I mean, Malazan is more densely, like, it's a more complicated plot than A Song of Ice and Fire, and there are more characters, but he's much better at moving things forward and advancing, like, time when he needs to. And each book has, like, a, you know, a lot of self-contained story arcs that are answered at the end, so you always get kind of a satisfying convergence at the end of each book, whereas Feast Dance kind of lacks that.
That is true. Anyone else on that? No. I just found it shocking. It also, maybe also shocking and depressing, I don't know. We, as a reread, started putting out episodes on A Feast for Crows in December 2017. And we finished it in July 2019. So, yeah, there's that. You know,
that I don't think is depressing. Like,
that's actually quite good going, right? Because we've done Dance in Between and Bits of Storm. I mean, there was a period when all three books were on the go, so that's kind of cool.
Yeah.
And it's nice
And we have a lot of episodes, and that's fun and nice, and I'm happy about that.
And we've done Game of Thrones and all sorts of other stuff in between. But, you know, in that period of time, we've had podcast babies, podcast, you know, like lots of stuff has happened in the world of a podcast device, and of Vassals of Kingsgrave in that time. Anyway, so we are done with May. Goodbye May, goodbye Feast. It's all very momentous, and let us get into Danny Six. So
should we say hi to Xander before?
Oh, is Xander here?
He joined us.
Oh, perfect. Hey, Xander.
Hello. I just wanted to stop in and say hello.
Hey, it's lovely to hear from you. I haven't spoken with you for a long time. So this is the Lord Baron from the forums, everyone. How's it going, Xander?
That's going all right. How about you guys?
We are surviving.
There are various states of hungoverness and tiredness on this group.
I'm trying to find a comfortable spot on this chair to sit. That's all I'm trying to do right now.
It takes a lot of your energy, obviously.
Oh my god.
But yeah, I just want to stop by and say hi. It looks like you guys are going to have an awesome time. This is a great group of people.
Well, thank you. Can you believe that a year ago in reread time, Renly was still alive? It just blows my mind how densely plotted.
That is crazy.
Yeah, like these books are so insane. All right, well, thank you so much for dropping by. It's a shame you can't stay, but have a great afternoon.
Yeah, have fun, you guys.
Bye.
Thanks, Andrew.
Okay, so back to May 300. We ended episode 88 on Sam 5 from Feast. We then skipped to Danny 6 from Dance, and this takes place on the next day, May 22nd. And I believe it is over to Michael for the chapter summary.
Okay, let's get into this. Daenerys visits the Astapori refugees camped outside of Meereen. More are arriving each day, and the food stores that they have to give them are dwindling. Against the advice of her advisors, she dismounts and personally helps the sick and dying. She returns to her pyramid and discusses the wedding rituals with Reznak Mereznak and Galaza Galari. The wedding must be done in Giskari style for her people to accept the marriage, but Daenerys will not permit her body to be inspected for fertility and similarly refuses to wash the feet of her husband. At dinner, Hisda agrees with breaking the ancient marriage traditions, but also brings the Yunkish terms for peace. Yunkai requires gold and gems to recompensate them for their lost slaves, and Yunkai must be allowed to resume slaving as well as to rebuild Astapor as a slave city. Daario Naharis returns to Meereen that night to inform Dany that the Yunkish are now on the march. The Stormcrows have gathered several deserters to their ranks, but the Yunkish now have four free companies in their service. The Company of the Cat, the Long Lancers, the Windblown, and the Second Sons, which have now defected. Daenerys orders the gates to be shut to the Astapori refugees and dismisses all but Daario, who she commands to disrobe. And that's Dany 6.
Getting the D.
Some hot Daario action.
He's such a nasty piece of shit. Fuck off, Daario. Like, the way he disses Barristan, calling him, like, Sir Uncle. And then Dany doesn't even do anything to stop him. She's just lost in her own world and her own thoughts and selfish kind of, like...
She's schmitten.
She's... Oh. But, you know, like, this guy is just blatantly disrespecting one of your most respected, trusted advisors. You don't do anything, and then you fuck him? Oh, that just really annoyed me.
Yeah, anyone who crosses Sir Barristan is a fucking prick.
I mean, it must take... He doesn't even respond. Like, it's... I'm even, like, saying, come on, Barristan, say something.
It's I think Barristan just isn't going to give him the dignity of responding. He's above that.
He's just so
used to it.
Yeah, getting bullied by Rayleigh and Littlefinger at court.
Yeah, and the Mad King and Joffrey. Like, Dario's nothing to him, like, compared to those guys.
I feel that there's something about being, like, in the Kingsguard and just having to sit there and watch mad shit and listen to really offensive stuff. And you probably just, like, build up this immunity and this thick skin towards stupidity, but it's still very frustrating for me.
I think you almost had to with Aerys. I mean, you had to build a wall, right?
Yeah, like Jamie says, go inside.
Right.
Yeah, don't come out again. Yeah, it is the problem with the like terms of service, essentially, of being in the Kingsguard.
So unhealthy.
So while I do think that some of the Targaryens at least have genetic disease resistance, I still think it was a bit not the smartest thing to go mingle with all the dying refugees. Like, I know it, like, it stems from Daenerys's frustration that she can't help people, and it's like this very childlike urge to go out there, but yeah.
Why is she taking Viserys' word for it? She's like, he told me. Oh, who cares what he told you?
Well, she knows that she hasn't her experience yet, so.
Yeah.
There is something to it.
I don't know, that's a lot to gamble.
Do you all think this is how Fagon's going to be exposed, because he'll get grayscale and she won't?
I think he'll try binding with a dragon, and it'll reject him in front of, like, a big crowd. That's just my idea.
Yeah, I agree with that as the most probable scenario.
Because dragons trump everything in this world. I hate dragons.
You maester.
Yeah, I'm team maester all the way.
Okay, so yeah, the next thing I was going... Crackling is the noises Missandei hears. Yeah, Missandei does notice that there is like scratching, and she thinks it's the refugees scratching. I was wondering if this is like the dragons trying to get out of the pyramids, but I just thought that was such a weird line.
Or she's just going crazy. I would agree it's probably the dragons scratching, trying to get out. Because they have like quite the cavern dug in there, don't they?
Yeah, it's like massive.
Yeah, they burrow.
Yeah, good old Rhaegal is like up the top. He's got his own little nest to hang from upside down. So in this chapter, Daenerys is talking to Hisdar, and Hisdar is like, yeah, let's get rid of all these crappy traditions, that's fine. And I thought that was interesting, because he's like this halfway reformer. Later in A Dance of the Dragons, I think in the final Barristan chapter, he has like a Freudian slip where he refers to one of his concubines as a bed slave. So he's obviously not like a full revolutionary, but I just thought, interesting character perspective.
And yeah, he's just kind of trying to suck up to Danny and, you know, play the game. I don't think he's very serious in most of his reform things. He's just kind of
trying to find his way into power.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. He's going along with it for the power and not really, you know, he's basically like looking for his chance to fight or, you know, get her out of there and take over.
And he starts taking a pretty heavy hand right away once he is like, king? What do we call him?
Yeah, he's king through his marriage. I would say the opposite. He's like a little bitch when he holds court. Like, but that's a discussion for another
chapter, he's holding court. I just think he kind of like waltzes in there after he's confirmed, whatever you say it is. But he just kind of starts doing things that she doesn't want to do, but doesn't really give her much of a choice sometimes, and tells her it's for the better.
I think it's more on Danny just choosing to allow it.
Like, right, picking her battles.
That's one of her main things. It takes her too long in most of these marine chapters to put her foot down.
It's like she's as exhausted with these people as we are listening to about them.
So true.
Did we talk about the disease and stuff that Danny kind of dealt with early on in the chapter yet?
Well, not other than her immunity to it, although I thought the descriptions of plague were really good, and actually it's not something you often see written about in war books, so continues George's aim of showing what war and disease really wreak on people.
The one where she's walking past a dude who appears to have a black cloak on him, and then it turns out to be 1,000 flies.
Flies, yeah.
Yeah. And then one maybe some of our hungover friends can relate to, shitting out their lives.
It's too real.
James, you said you were trying to sit on a seat, right? Was that a toilet seat?
It was a throne.
I've got like a high kitchen table, and I like my feet can't touch the ground in the seat that I'm sitting in. It's so uncomfortable. I'm trying to just find a comfy spot. I feel like I'm just slowly dying. But carry on, folks.
He's just trying to like really get into the theme of the chapter here.
Yeah, this is like method podcasting.
Yeah,
I think Dani here has. I applaud that she wants to help them, but at the same time, she's not listening to her advisors at all. It might work out for her, it might not, but it just seems so sketchy to not listen to them at all.
Yeah, I mean, you know, in retrospect, this chapter is fine because none of her, you know, people...
all the Unsullied are fine.
Yeah, get sick and die from this, which is the main risk. Like, I have no problem with her walking into the camp. It's just the risking her soldiers' lives, but...
Yeah, the most important people. All of their, like, leading generals and, you know, if Grey Worm dies, like, what happens to the Unsullied?
Yeah, I think that'd be fine. They're just choosing to follow him. They'd follow her no matter what.
Right. Well, I mean, just in terms of... disappointing. Yeah, maybe leadership within them. I don't think their loyalty will be questioned, but, you know, if he died, would they be as effective?
I think so. Yeah, they're so well-trained.
They are well-trained, but I think he organizes a lot of things among them, and they are very well-trained, but they are not well-trained at being free, and he's kind of being a good, I think...
middleman.
Yeah, he's helping them to that transition.
Yeah, he serves as a good role model as kind of giving giving them an out after the war, you know, the wars are all done and the story is all done, where the surviving ones, you know, through his leadership kind of have a chance of making a new life for themselves. I mean, granted, he's probably going to die, but still.
Why so pessimistic? None of our favorite characters die.
Winter is coming, Brett. Winter is coming.
Yeah, he'll stick around for a while because he's the only, you know, built-up Unsullied character. But yeah.
So in this chapter, there's a bit of prophetic interpretation. Daenerys thinks that Brown Ben Plum is the treason for gold, but initially she thought it was going to be Daario. And I don't think it's either character, but I thought it was interesting the way prophecy is treated in Daenerys' storyline when you contrast it with Cersei's. Because with Cersei, there's a very clear message that, like, don't know your future, it can only lead to bad things. But I feel like something different is going on with Daenerys and prophecy.
How do you mean?
So you can see with the prophecy with Cersei, it, like, consumes her and very clearly, like, destroys her. And it's a self-fulfilling prophecy. But the way Daenerys treats the prophecies she's been given, it's in the back of her mind, but it's not consuming her the same way. And I feel like there's a moral or a message that George is trying to convey about prophecy that we'll see through Daenerys' story. Like, he doesn't just think prophecies are bad. That's all they are. There's something else, but I don't know what it is.
And you'd kind of think it'd be the opposite way around. Like, you'd think Dany would be consumed because she's had so much fantastical things happen to her, whereas Cersei, she's just more self-absorbed, and that she just thinks everything is about her, so she would take that prophecy more to heart. That, and she's watching it come true all around her.
And I think because it's capitulating on her preconceived notions, like she already hated Tyrion and she already had reason to fear another queen that would replace her. So, yeah, I think it builds on pre-established things, I guess.
And she told her friend was going to die that night, and she did.
Was it that night? I thought it might have just been afterwards at some undefined point.
Okay. Well, she told her she was going to die, and she did.
Yeah, she did
pretty
die.
Soon.
Yeah, that is kind of a difference where Dany's prophecies are a little bit more ambiguous. Whereas, you know, Cersei's had some, like, clear, defined things that have come to pass. And where Dany is kind of, like, is never really sure whether, you know, this certain thing counts as this betrayal or not. Or whether there's, you know, there's still another one to come.
And Cersei sought them out, whereas Daenerys, they were kind of just thrown at her.
Yeah.
Well, Dany's also got a shitload of prophecies.
Yeah, she has to struggle to keep track.
Yeah, I know, right? she just gives up. Just let's crack on. Fuck it.
If I think about them all lost.
Yeah.
Maybe Maggie the Frog. Maybe she's a bit like kind of like a cheap magician. Can do a few things like predict the king's bastards or something like that. And then suckers you into... And that's the real curse is actually... the Valonqar and the queen, the younger, more beautiful queen, is bollocks. And she just pulled a few cheeky predictions out, and then the rest is just left to torture her.
Where did she pull them out from?
Well, maybe she had some magic. Some, she you know, was like
pretty
like
specific.
Thoros, I was being very rude. Sorry.
You know, like Thoros has a few abilities.
Yeah, exactly.
I don't know.
She's like a hedge prophecy.
I would like that. I would like that if it all turned out to be nothing and she was, you know, I don't know, just kills herself when she inevitably tries to blow up King's Landing or something. I don't know.
That would be brilliant.
So like a Ricky Bobby's father moment. She's like, oh, I was just making all that shit up. I based my life around those prophecies.
Yeah.
Like the Wizard of Oz.
Yeah. I mean, Dany's a little different too, because like, you know, even though they're annoyingly obtuse, it's, you know, it seems that like Quaithe is trying to, you know, aid her in some way, where, you know, stuff with Cersei was pretty much just like antagonistic.
Almost meant to hurt.
Yeah, doom and gloom.
So in this scene, in this chapter, she gets it on with Daario, of course. If you guys have read Mirrani's Blot, they talk about Daenerys making all these sacrifices to achieve the peace, but then being unsatisfied with it, and she subconsciously starts to break it. So I would argue that this is the first step in her breaking the peace that she's basically just made. And it's interesting because she'll go on to make further sacrifices, but already she's not happy with it. Or in her situation, of course.
Do you buy into that? This idea that Dany is like a subconsciously self-sabotaging queen?
I think she just bit off a lot more than she could chew in a place that didn't want to be chewed.
She's in conflict with herself, certainly.
Not necessarily sabotage. Oh, I mean, it is sabotaging, but maybe she senses there's another way, or she just doesn't want to go through with it.
I must say, I never thought, it never seemed to me that she would ever accept what, you know, any deal that, Astapor and Yunkai and all these other people would try to make. You know, it's just if they wanted a fight, there was going to be a fight, because there's no way she was going to back down from the principles. She's already kind of walked along this path. She's already pot committed down this path and this overall goal and kind of how the people of Essos view her. And so she was never going to back down from people trying to rise up and resume the slave trade.
Right. She really has a heart, for lack of a better word. Like, she just really cares about these people and wants them to have better lives, and it seems like it doesn't work out great for her in wanting them to have better lives, but maybe it's just the people she's listening to that's the issue.
I don't know. It's also not completely altruistic, because it's equal parts like she wants to improve people's situation that, you know, was similar with kind of what she experienced growing up, but at the same time she also just wants to burn and murder, you know, those that have caused, you know, so much pain and suffering in the world.
What do you think of, apparently Jock said that Sarah thinks that Dany is the harpy?
Oh, no, she's no, okay.
That's,
No, that was a, Sarah doesn't believe that specifically, that was just, you know, a random crackpot theory that she, you know, found on the internet and threw out, so it's, you know, as a,
okay, we
a
can
Tyler
move on.
Durden.
I can edit that out then. Okay.
Yeah, a silly Tyler Durden.
How would that go? Like, she's commanding people to kill her own people.
Yeah,
and it's with the Unsullied though, so like whatever, I'm just gonna obey, even if the order's contradictory.
Yeah.
Okay.
What do we all think of the fact that the Unsullied apparently have their own religion?
Yeah, I thought about that.
I had completely forgotten about that from previous reads of this.
Yeah,
and I
was
like, this is really fascinating. And it's very lightly coloured in, like there's not much detail given. But I thought it was kind of beautiful that they had their own purification ritual. I kind of don't need to know more, but I thought it felt quite elegant. And
I'm assuming this is something the slavers gave them?
Well, that's
right?
What I was wondering. Yeah. Or is it something they've brought from their original lives?
There's too many different backgrounds of the people for them to have like one solid religion, because they take slaves from everywhere.
I think it was more of a warrior religion as opposed to a slave religion. Because isn't it like the goddess of battle was like one of the names of...
But I'm wondering if it's the slave traders that imbue them with this religion. Like they want them to believe that there's a higher calling, maybe?
Yeah, the fact that the slave masters can't know her name, I just thought was really interesting. And maybe it suggests
that... they
didn't
want to make one up.
They were lazy.
Yeah,
that detail makes me think it might be a slave tradition that's being peddled to the Unsullied through each generation by themselves. Like that, this is their one act of rebellion.
This genitals burning, isn't that what happened to Varys?
Yeah.
Huh.
And didn't he see a vision after that, too?
I thought, like, evil or something. He said the voice he heard was evil or something.
Yeah, I wonder if, like, the Unsullied go through that as well.
Wait, Grey Worm is Varys?
I don't think I said that, but...
Sarah said it. Blame all the practical theories on her.
I don't think there's a magic ritual involved, you know, in the castration of the Unsullied, like there was in Varys' case.
Doesn't it say in this chapter, all those who have had their manhood burnt on the brazier? So I thought that actually might be the ritual by which the Unsullied are castrated. It gets thrown onto a fire.
Hmm.
Maybe.
I mean, yeah, maybe.
Yeah.
But and then it would be more... It would be more as a, you know, it would just be more as a symbol, like, you know, landing and burning the ships than it would be in, you know, with any specific purpose.
Yeah, exactly. That's what I was thinking as well. It's like in a very more hardcore way, the same idea than, I don't know if they do that in the Night's Watch, but when you arrive, you burn everything you had with you before and you leave it all behind. Or what Arya is going through with the Faceless Men. It's like, well, no, now it's just burned and it's behind you, but much more hardcore, obviously.
It can't be sewed back on. It's gone.
I mean, it's psychological more than an actual magical ritual.
Yeah, and that's why I think, you know, is kind of one of the purposes of the religion they created is to help them, you know, cope with the traumatic experience they've gone through as well as kind of make them into soldiers who can kill without hesitation and whatever.
So do you think it was the soldiers themselves that created it and like just told that to the new soldiers?
Yeah, I think it could go either way. It could be something as a response in order as a coping mechanism or something, you know, specifically purposefully implanted in them by the slave masters to make them better at what they do.
Do you think they have compassion?
I think they've demonstrated, I think in stuff that they've, stories of them we've had in Marine, I think there have been slight examples of.
Yeah, like wanting to lay with a woman just to lay with her. Yeah. Like he can't do anything. He just wants to like cuddle.
Yeah. I think they're perhaps reawakening to it a little bit.
Right. She's given them hope.
Yeah.
And hope has grown.
Anything else on this chapter?
Yeah.
You want to go first now?
I just wanted a little consensus on Dario. Do we think he's a badass or completely full of shit?
Completely well, Bina, full of you want to take this one?
Completely full of shit. How is this even a question, Pops? I'm just like disappointed in you.
Well, I don't know. I mean, I don't know. I like the stories of him reaching down some guy's throat and pulling his heart out and dodging arrows. And...
I am Darkstar. No. I am of the night. It falls into that category of just bollocks, machismo. I mean, like, maybe he is doing some shit like that. I bet he's doing about 10% of what he says he's doing, though.
Yeah, well, Barristan certainly doesn't buy
10% of 1,000 is still a lot, so good for him.
I don't rate him.
Also, he has blue hair. Like,
I like people who just go about their business, don't talk about it, just get the job done, Nike style. Just do it.
Like Barristan. No, no offense to anyone who has blue hair in real life. We do respect you and thank you all.
We love you, Amber Rocks. Yeah.
I mean, I think he's somewhat capable, but I think his style of fighting is not built around going toe-to-toe.
He has no honor.
It might be around going toe-to-toe, but not necessarily like in a battle sort of way. Like I kind of see him as a, I don't know, just a random, just run up behind people and stab them kind of thing than actually like an honest fight.
No,
he's wily.
He's all about like movement. Yeah, he's all about moving around as quickly as possible.
Low cunning.
And, you know.
Yeah,
no, I think for sure he's dangerous. Like I wouldn't, you know, I think him going up against Barristan could go either way.
What? No way.
I think it would depend on if Barristan was ready or not.
Right, yeah. So, like, I mean...
Barristan's a cannibal now.
Yeah, unless Barristan was in full, like, Barristan would need full plate plus the helmet to take him.
Nah.
a throwing dagger to the eye is instant. Like, there's not much Barristan can do about that unless
he cut it out of the
full
air.
Armor on. He's not quick enough to do that.
He'd swallow it.
Barristan's a sword swallower now, too, huh? Weird.
Was I the only one who pictured that scene from Ace Ventura when he reached down and pulled out the apple core out of the guy's stomach? That's all I thought about.
Very good.
Temple of Doom in there, too. There's a particular line at the end of this chapter that really stuck out to me as fucking file away. And that is at the very end there, you know, after they hear about Brown, Ben, Plum or whatever, where Danny essentially like pleads to Dario, like, promise me that you will never turn against me. I could not bear it. Promise me. And that just seems like something that's going to go fucking downhill at the worst possible moment in the future of these books.
Chekhov's pleading. If you make a point of ending a chapter on that note, he's going to betray her at some point.
Right, yeah. He's like, never, my love. You know, it's just like, oh, Jesus.
And that's
the point where, like, I don't really mind Dario that much, but it's just, Danny's just not quite as wary enough as she needs to be.
Is she just crushing so hard she's blind?
Yeah,
definitely.
We've all been there in our teenage years. I mean, how old is Danny at this point?
She's a teenager.
16?
16, yeah.
Yeah.
16. Yeah, this is
spot on. I mean, that's one of the points of Dario, right? It's to show that she's still a teenager. And even though we see her doing not so bad at actually trying to rule, I mean, I think she makes mistakes, but she's not that stupid. But then we see her with Dario and we're like, yeah, still 16.
How do we feel about all the marriage rituals where she's basically asked to be inspected by her future husband's family as basically a breeding cow?
I think that actually happens in Westeros too. Don't they inspect the bride? Make sure she's not.
That doesn't make it any more okay.
I didn't say it was. But I'm just saying back then.
So the point is George isn't making a point about Essos, which is often an accusation that's thrown at him, that this is just the times being misogynistic.
Yeah, did she make a point? She was like, oh, let's get married in Westerosi fashion, and actually it's just as degrading.
Yeah, I mean, the men carry you off and strip you down as you're brought to the bed. I mean, is that better?
No.
I think so. Instead of a few women inspecting you, which is kind of gross, but it seems like it'd be less invasive. But
everything is terrible. I mean, like, being carried off to your marital beds with the whole family watching and actually tearing the clothes off you is quite invasive.
why would you
not as invasive as your future mother-in-law sticking a finger up your what's-it to check you're still intact.
That's what I was getting at.
Scary. So very well written. I was just thinking, like, for George as this sort of like old white guy, he kind of gets it a little bit, which is just amazing. Anyway, none of that will be in the podcast, but I thought I would share that.
Yeah, on another note similar to that, where you can cut this out if you want to, where, you know, I really enjoyed reading this chapter. Like, I like the harsh, very descriptive nature of this plague and Danny going through it. And I like her making that, you know, harsh decision at the end to close the gates and whatnot. But all I could think about with her attending this kind of plague camp is, you know, related to shit that's, you know, going on in the U.S. at this point. And I think, like, you know, the day I read this chapter may have been the day after that, like, Pence and all them visited the camps over, you know, near the southern border. And it was, it's all I can, like, think about and compare it to.
Yeah, it's scarily on message, isn't it? It's scarily on point, both in the way in which women's bodies are treated culturally and the way in which refugees are treated. And yeah, it's it was a very, like, I don't normally like the Danny chapters in Feast Dance, but this one was so resonant in so many ways. And yet it's probably one of the more fanciful ones. And yet it's amazing how the writing can still speak to us.
It's crazy. We're talking about something that would have happened so long ago, but she didn't even put those people in cages. Just throwing that out there.
Well, because they had walls. Walls, they're so good. They're great. Anyway.
The greatest wall ever.
Since we have a couple of women on the call, how does George, like, how do you feel about the way he writes women? Do you think he does an exceptional job? Or, because I've never been a woman, so I don't really know what it's like.
Sorry.
You need to, just as I embrace my inner sausage, I think you need to embrace your.
You want to go first, Dina?
I just think he writes characters well. And I think, you know, some of my favorite characters he's written are women, and the women are various, right? Everything from romantic Sansa as a child to Cersei, who has major penis envy and is power crazed, to people like like Sir Aaron, who have been very traumatized by miscarriage and have been made paranoid by it, to, you know, people like Kat, who I genuinely do think Kat's quite a good mum. And there's just a beautiful range to people like Arya, who are very sort of, you know, not conventional, and Brienne. There's a beautiful diversity of womanhood, which I really appreciate. And I think that, yeah, in general, I'm happy. I know that you can talk about his treatment of sexual violence and his depiction of sexuality. So do I like, you know, seeing endless scenes of Dany, you know, pleasuring herself or whatever, maybe not. So I think there's how he treats female sexuality. But I think in general, just getting inside the minds of women, qua women, is kind of interesting. Like, it's interestingly good considering his personal background, I think.
Because we don't think he's ever been a woman either, right?
Again, you're so judgmental and so categorizing of people.
I said we don't think.
Mary, yeah, over to you.
Yeah, I agree with you, Bina. The main thing for me is that, I mean, would you guys say that there is one way of being a man? I don't think so. And the same way, there's not one way of being a woman. So, I don't even really know what it means to write women well, in the sense that he writes characters well. That's what Bina said. And they're various.
I guess, yeah. I was just saying, like, a point of view from, like, an experience that you would have and how you would react to it. Like, do you get what I'm saying?
So yeah, I think things like Sansa is a romantic child I really relate to. I think Dany is a 16-year-old falling for the stupid bad guy I totally relate to. But there are whole categories of experience in here, like being a mother and how you would protect your children, that I'm not going to be a mum, so I don't know. Just as, you know, so that's so far beyond my experience to even judge. I think he writes great characters. I don't think he handles sexuality well. And, you know, that's not just about women and the way he sexualizes them or deals with sexual violence. I think that comes with how he handles LGBTQ characters and, you know, all sorts of stuff. But in general,
That's quite reassuring that he can write women as interesting characters that are not unidimensional or anything, and that he handles sexuality so bad. It's reassuring in the sense that it's not one of the same to him, thankfully. Yeah. Like, women that are not just there for their sexual aspect,
and the fact that he even cares, right? Nice. I mean, there yeah. are many contemporary authors, let alone historical ones, who don't care enough to write about women's experiences. And I think part of why we love George and his mission statement is to write about marginalized characters, like what happens to the small folk when you have war. And I think part of that mission includes what happens to women, and that's why you get so much sexual violence. So I kind of applaud him for his mission. And does it always work? Not necessarily, but it's a good mission. And people like the Queen of Thorns, people like Marjorie, they all have agency. And, you know, Dany may make stupid choices in terms of sleeping with Dario, but she's so much more than that, you know. And I love all of that. I think it's great. Honestly, I wouldn't have spent so long with these books if I didn't think they were representing women in a compelling way.
Thank you. I was curious. So.
Thank you. Strangely earnest conversation. Anything more chapter specific, though, before we move on? Nope. Okay. Well, after that particularly...
Maybe with the whole how the Giscari don't recognize the lights of the Seven as God, as being valid, and if that have the similar sort of relevance to all the other religions, like, would Sansa's marriage with Tyrion be valid by the ideas of the old god worshippers in the north, or if they got a hold of her, would they use that as a sort of way out of it?
So they could say that she's not married to Tyrion with us because she didn't do it in front of a heart tree and in front of the old gods.
Yeah.
Okay. Interesting.
Well, Danny's definitely
the old gods and the new gods. There's a bit of synthesis there that you don't see with other religions, just because Westeros is composed of these two people, and they often make the swearing to be by the old gods and the new. Mm-hmm. So I guess it depends how they word the marriage. I can't remember how it was done.
It definitely wasn't in front of a hard tree.
True.
But that point does apply well to, you know, the method of which Dany is going to be able to marry again to, you know, some Westerosi dude later on in the series.
Yeah, for sure. His dar is definitely going to be...
I have a feeling it won't be an issue.
Invalid.
He might not make it through it.
Yeah, that too.
Okie dokie. Well, on that note, let's move on to the next chapter. So after Danny 6, we jump forward 12 chapters and 180 pages in my edition to Jamie 1. So if you were in love with Jamie, as I was at the time, you would have had to wait 6 years to read this chapter. It's one of two that appears in A Dance with Dragons, so I'll leave it to you to decide whether it was worth the wait. It takes place a day later on May 23rd, and gird yourself, Queen James. I hope you're sitting comfortably. It's Queen James with the chapter summary.
Alrighty. Jamie arrives at Raventree Hall. It is under siege by Janos Bracken. The siege is going slowly because they want to starve out the Blackwoods rather than attack their castle. Jamie first meets with Lord Janos. He walks into his tent and he is having sex with a camp follower named Hildy. After she leaves, Jamie talks to Janos about the situation, and Janos wants to acquire a quarter of House Blackwood's lands after the siege is over. Jamie, I think in his head, thinks that that's a little much, but he doesn't really say much to Janos at the time. He gets some information from Janos. Hold on 1 second.
Listeners, I'm sorry. I said there were two Jamie chapters. There's only one adult.
Okay, I was wondering at that.
Jamie kind of questions the Brackens' intent because they started off with the Starks. And Janos Bracken pretty much tells him that, you know, when he took fealty for the king, he would follow him just like he followed the Starks. And so I guess Jamie's kind of taken with that. I don't know. He was also upset that he lost men at the Red Wedding, and then he still ended up bending the knee to the crown. After that, Jamie gets a chance to go in and parlay with Tidos Blackwood. Inside the castle, they see the massive werewood tree that the castle gets its name by. It doesn't have any leaves, and it's been dead for over 1,000 years. They say that in another 1,000 years, it's going to turn to stone. And every night, thousands of ravens come back to the tree and fill its branches. Jamie is talking to Tidos Blackwood about terms, and he tells him how much lands the Brackens want. Blackwood obviously says that he's not with that, and they kind of decide to give up some of his lands, and he gets to decide which lands he wants to give up. Jamie also says that he's going to take a hostage. Originally, Janos Bracken wanted him to take Tidos Blackwood's only daughter, Bethany, but I think Jamie has sympathy for that, and instead he decides to take one of his sons. He takes his most bookish son, Hoster, and Jamie even thinks that Hoster and Tyrion would get along because Hoster is such a bookish boy and he likes to learn and give information. Throughout some part of the chapter, we do get like an info dump on the history of the Blackwoods and the Brackens, which is pretty interesting just to get some history. Their feud is thousands of years old, and I don't think people really understand exactly how it started. Of course, the Blackwoods say that the Brackens took lands from them, and I think it's, you know, vice versa. They're on their way to Pennytree to stay for the night. And when they show up at the gates, they are denied entrance into the hold fast because the villagers took refuge in there when they saw them coming. And I just got thoughts of Monty Python. And I'm just thinking that they're going to be screaming at Jamie about how his mother was a hamster. like the French guys in Monty Python. Anyways, so they are at Pennytree. He sends out scouts, which come back with Brienne. Brienne comes back with bandages on her face, and she looks 10 years older than when Jamie left her last. She is holding the sword Oathkeeper, and Brienne tells him that she has found Sansa and that he must come alone or else Sandor Clegane will kill the girl. That's where the chapter ends, but obviously I would assume that he goes with Brienne.
Agreed. That's it.
Is it actually Brienne, though?
How could it not be?
Yeah, it must be.
Huh.
Oathkeeper, well, she's got Oathkeeper. Has to be.
Do you think it's a faceless man? Like, what do you...
When I first read this chapter, seeing Brienne and seeing, I guess, how much she changed between the time that Jamie had seen her last and seeing that there wasn't, it just didn't seem like there was much light behind her eyes. I actually thought originally that maybe she did die when she was being hung. And then, you know, they gave her the gift of life back. And so she's kind of more of a servant to Stoneheart rather than having her own autonomy, I guess. So that's kind of what I thought, just because it doesn't seem... I know Brienne obviously cares for, you know, the men that she was traveling with, but I think that she really holds a torch for Jaime, and I don't know that she would give up Jaime's life for Pod, or want to make that decision. So I thought that maybe even if she did, you know, scream out sword or whatever, maybe she did end up dying and they, you know, they brought her back and lost part of herself with that.
Possibly. I'd never thought of it. I just assumed she's going to try to talk her way out of it.
But we know Brienne. Do you really think she could talk her way out of it?
No. I think she wants to get Jaime to explain his side.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
I mean, she's just trying to figure something out. She needed to do something in order to buy time and make sure that Pod and Hyle didn't die on the spot. And now she's just desperately, you know, trying to figure out a way to save Jaime as well.
She's Indiana Jonesing it and making it up as she goes.
Yeah.
I seriously don't know what she's doing or what she plans to do, but I also really, really hope that she's not some kind of Lady Stoneheart 2.0, because that's just, no, please, I want Brienne to be the actual Brienne.
I mean, it's got to be trial by combat, right?
She'll just be his champion against Lemoncloak.
Yeah. Thoros. Maybe Thoros.
No, I don't know that Thoros would be willing to fight.
I don't think you'd take up the sword against him.
Yeah, I think for a while, you know, I've never really tried to get a grasp on what I think might happen just because it's so unpredictable.
Yeah.
But I think a requirement or something that really might be needed for their survival is some sort of infighting between the members of the Brotherhood who perhaps do not like the direction that Stoneheart is taking them.
Well, what if Brienne slayed Lady Stoneheart?
Yeah, that is another possibility that people have thrown around as a possible outcome. It just seems a little early to take Stoneheart out the game like that.
Yeah, her story doesn't feel done yet.
Neither does Brienne's, which is why it'd be weird if she were dead.
Well, Jaime's.
Right. Yeah. No, I don't expect them to die either. I mean, this. I think this most closely relates to the visions that the two of them have had of, or it's maybe more specifically Jaime's dream of, you know, them fighting back to back with flaming swords in the dark and all that.
So what would be the narrative point of Stoneheart to bring? I mean, because if so, we all agree that Brienne and Jaime probably can't die in this encounter, then what would be her point to, like, come back and continue fucking up the frays?
Yeah, I mean, well, I think, you know, a big part of Winds is, you know, whatever Thomas Evans is trying to devise. And so I think that, you know, before the Brotherhood can be destroyed entirely, that big event needs to occur.
The Red Wedding 2.0.
Yeah, or at least an attempt at it, and, you know, at least it being partially successful, I think.
I feel like thematically the point of Lady Stoneheart is like the theoretical end point of where revenge gets you. Like, Lady Stoneheart is nothing but the embodiment of revenge, and you can see, you know, how awful she is and how it's affected the Brotherhood. So thematically, I can sort of see where it's going.
Would Jaime, I mean, because presumably the Red Wedding, this new next one is going to be with Davin Lannister getting married, right?
Yeah, in Riverrun, perhaps.
So then would Jaime would he be present and complicit and help it happen?
Huh.
Is that how he gets out of it?
Oh, so they talk their way into,
I think Jaime will be in King's Landing by that point. But yeah, just an idea.
Hmm.
I mean, clearly Jaime isn't going to be killed. They've done too much with him to throw him away as a character. Look at how much growth he's had since he lost his hand. I mean, even this chapter right here where he's, like, talking to these two guys and he's showing that he is intelligent, he's good. I don't know about good at bargaining because he kind of just gives them both what they want, but he didn't give either one of them all of what they wanted. I don't know. It'd be weird if they just took him out of the game at this point.
Yeah. I feel like he keeps having to reel off that Reigns of Castamere line, and he should just be like, blah blah blah, you know how it goes, da 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 da.
every time he's negotiating with someone.
It's effective, man. Like, you know, that's one of the things I like about, you know, Jamie as a character, where, you know, when he needs to dig into that scumminess, he just dives in and doesn't care. But he is willing to use kind of what hands he's been dealt,
right, using his reputation, you know. the negative part of his reputation, he's using it as a positive kind of.
Yeah, no, I like that. No, I know who I'm dealing with, Kingslayer. That kind of line at the end, is a really good one. And I like the way that how Jamie kind of uses his reputation and this like gray area that he plays around in. It's just a fascinating character to me.
Until someone calls him on it.
Right.
I'm curious what he would do. Like, I don't believe he would have thrown a baby with a trebuchet into River Run, but maybe.
Absolutely not.
I don't think so, but.
Yeah, but I think we have no way of knowing, and we really, really hope he wouldn't have done it, but
right.
It's and not like so I said, clear.
He's playing on his reputation,
yeah.
Deserved or not.
For sure.
Right, yeah, but like that, I mean, that reputation has been so pervasive, you know, throughout this story that like no one's going to call, like there are very few people, characters who would be willing to call him on that.
He wouldn't fling a baby into River Run, but he'd push a child out a window.
Right.
Well, it's Tyrion-esque, isn't it? You know, using his reputation as armor.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Their father taught him that.
Yeah.
Did anyone else find it a little funny that it was called Lord Tytos, which is Tywin's dad, I think. And he's just so I don't know, he's just completely just, he's like, well, you're here. I can now submit to you. Just like, you know, Tytos is quite a pushover.
Indeed.
Well, yeah.
I mean, not really. I mean, it was the only prudent course of action.
People are starving.
No, of course. I mean, you know, if he was called Stannis Blackwood, then maybe you'd kind of get it a bit more, I guess. But
I think it also shows that either George is running out of names, or just the Riverlands and the Westerlands just they share names. Like the kid is named Hoster, and yeah.
I appreciate the fact he uses names, though. It makes it feel more realistic to me.
Yeah, definitely. Because like I know 1,000 Marys beside me, so.
That's something I noticed, and I wanted to ask you guys about the Blackfish and him potentially stopping by Raventree Hall. You know, Tytos doesn't really quite give a. I mean, obviously he's never going to tell Jaime, but I think it's very possible. I mean, and then in like as soon as he asks him, the next paragraph he says that his heir is called Brynden. I think he must have helped him and knows what's going on.
Possibly.
I mean, maybe.
I don't know. Like, the whole thing feels like Jamie's sort of getting played, like the whole thing.
Yeah, it does kind of feel like everyone's like, oh, it's the big bad Kingslayer, but actually they're all just appeasing him for something else, you know, for the next big twist, I suppose.
Yeah.
Hmm.
Imagine how weird it would be if the whole thing's all fake.
Yeah. Black and black. They're both still on the north side and they're like pretending they're at siege and they're like just bringing food into the guys.
I mean, maybe, but there's not much, you know, there's not much really they can do until some, you know, they're kind of reliant on other people to bring disaster to, you know, either the Lannisters or the Boltons or whatever. They don't really have the forces anymore to mount a defense other than just like hide and wait it out and hope something turns in their favor.
Do the Lannisters have that big an army at this point? I mean, they got the Freys with them, but
with the Tyrells they do.
Oh, okay, mm-hmm. With the Tyrells, but are
and
they
have a lot of money, which is almost equivalent to having a big army.
I suppose.
Well, sellswords are pretty useless in this universe.
For sure, but they still, I think they still can, like, bring up a lot of people just because they have ways to pay them.
Right, and people are starving, and
yeah,
food's the bigger thing where they can keep a lot of the small folk on their side by providing them with food, whereas. You know, even like obviously the Riverlands are against the Lannisters and Freys at this point, but the populace in the south of Westeros still is not against the Lannisters, and so therefore can't offer support in that fashion.
And that's where all the food's coming from at this point.
Yeah.
So some people have accused George of muddying the waters with the Blackwood-Bracken conflict and the moral he's trying to go for. A lot of people think he's playing favorites with the Blackwoods. What do you guys think of this?
Does feel that way.
I think he played it out both ways. Like, he gave both perspectives and both think they have the right. And
particularly when you look back at history of the conflicts, like the Blackwoods are always the loyalists and the Brackens are rebels, and who was the favorite mistress of Aegon the Fourth, and just with a historical perspective.
Oh, I get what you're saying.
The Blackwoods always come out looking better.
Yeah, it does feel, yeah, it feels like they're the more likable of the two for sure.
Yeah, definitely.
So they're all dead.
Yeah, and it might be the fact that, like, because he did it that way because of the Blood Raven connection.
And I mean, we do need likable characters from time to time, right? I mean, it's part of the epicness of the story is that we do have some houses who, even though they seemingly bend a knee, are still more honorable than others, and that's what keeps us interested in the whole thing.
Oh, yeah, I agree. It's just that I can't think of one likable Bracken throughout all of this history.
Yeah, he's making...
His name is Bracken.
He's making a point, and he's going at it, like, without a lot of nuance, but but I understand it.
Do you guys think... Oh, go ahead.
No, go ahead.
I was just going to say, do you guys think that that big weirwood has... Do you think that that's part of, like, the weirwood network that Bran would be able to see out of? Because obviously the ravens keep coming back there. So I don't know, do you think it's part of... Like, do you think that's something that Bran would be able to see what was going on during this meeting?
Well, they mentioned the weird thing here in this chapter where they said the weirwood is dead.
Right,
and that's been dead for at least, you know, 1,000 years.
I don't trust their timekeeping, but yeah.
Right. Yeah. Well, no, and that's another thing this chapter makes is this is one of the specific chapters that points out, you know, was it 4,000 years? Was it 2,000 years? You know, stuff that people on
none
the internet
of the above
use to try and kind of hack away at the concept that the Long Night, you know, was 7,000 years ago, but we might just be completely wrong on that, and that it was, you know, it's been much less like time since that. But yeah, and then the other thing is the ravens that come back to roost every night is, you know, that's something where, you know, Blood Raven specifically like sends them out to scout each day and then, like, you know, leaves them alone at night and stuff like that. But, yeah.
It's just it's an interesting thing to drop in the middle of this chapter. Like, I obviously think he's planting a seed for the future, or maybe not. Maybe he's not. Maybe he's just like, yeah, see, my world has lots of fantasy in it. Cause it's just such an odd tidbit.
Leaving it open, maybe.
Huh?
Leaving it open.
Yeah. I mean, for all we know, like, well, we'll probably never get the second newer book, but, like, you might be reading that one and be like, oh, shit, that went down right here.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah, no, it's another...
The Children of the Forest did something right here in this spot that made this tree die, like, suck the life out of it.
Yeah, it's another possibility for a major ritual. Yeah, no, anything with the appearance of werewoods is always an interesting legend of history. And it's the same way in the Davos chapter when he kind of walks by the heart tree that's in the middle of White Harbor. You know, that's the type of stuff that is fascinating to me in trying to tease out clues and like the lore and the legends that we hear.
I think it doesn't necessarily have to have an impact on the future story. It's just, it's part of the world and it's nice to see it, even though, I mean, even if it doesn't play a part later.
Yeah.
Yeah, I agree 100%.
I'm fine if he leaves it at that. It's just so unique and interesting. Yeah. Just sprinkled into a random chapter.
Well, and while we're talking about trees, do you guys think that there's any significance with the penny tree, that all those pennies are just hammered into it, or what is that?
I liked that Jaime didn't want to know, because that's like Tyrion would want to know, but Jaime wouldn't. It says interesting things about each character.
Yeah, it definitely felt in character. You have to be careful when info dumping, you know, and stuff. If it doesn't fit in like narratively to the chapter you're writing, you know, that's kind of the balance you have to tread with info dumping. So yeah, so I like that it makes sense in this case that Jaime wouldn't ask about it, that we don't hear about it.
So it's mentioned in this chapter that Pennytree has been a royal fief for 100 years. So I have a theory based on basically nothing that we're going to see this in the Dunk and Egg story in one of the novellas. And through Dunk's actions, it will become a royal fief somehow.
Is that when Pennytree will start becoming Pennytree?
No, it's mentioned actually in the Hedge Knight, because as Jock pointed out, this is where Sir Arlen comes from. So it's already Pennytree at this point.
Okay.
But yeah, that's obviously going to include some like Bracken Blackwood rivalry.
Yeah, he'll have to force a truce or something.
Yeah,
I hope he writes that from like the opposite point of view, and the Bracken seem like the good guys.
That would be nice, seem like the bad guys for variety's sake.
Is it the time to say that we would love more Dunkin' Egg stories, but just only after wins? Let me make that clear.
Exactly. Yeah, no, it's definitely been too long since the last one.
Yeah.
We need another Dunkin' Egg story, but yeah, for sure after wins at this point.
Yeah, I'm looking at it and the Brackens are all absolute twats.
Yeah, they kind of join with like other houses, like the Peak, you know, the Peaks and the that have just been shit throughout the course of history.
Even the coolest one, Bittersteel, is a fucking arsehole.
Right, yeah, exactly. even at the end, Bittersteel is the shitty one. Then
there was a Bracken who was in Maegor's Kingsguard. Like, come on.
Did anybody play the Telltale Game of Thrones series?
I played some of it.
Yeah, do you think, not all the way through.
It's like the Brackens and the Blackwoods, I guess whatever, like in that game they had two houses that were rivals, like the Ironwoods and the something else.
Yeah, I remember.
Do you think, did they get like this, that storyline maybe from these two houses?
Possibly.
Just change the names and the domain.
Or they're just pulling from the age-old Romeo and Juliet, you know. They're just using that trope of a story, not necessarily.
Any two families that live next to each other are probably going to have some feuding.
Yeah.
I think it's interesting. Jamie thinks about both Tommen and Marcella quite often, well, increasingly. And then this, being honest about their parentage and stuff. And then you also get the line that Lord Jonos has a bastard son that no one believed was his because he was fair-haired. So that's Martin genetics.
Clearly a Lannister baby.
I took that as Blackwood propaganda because that's what Tytos says. Like, of course Tytos is going to say that.
If he's got fair hair, the seed is wrong.
Yeah, we get some of that from Hoster too, with, you know, saying that the Brackens were the, you know, the upjump like merchants or whatever, and the
petty
the Blackwoods
lords, yeah.
were the true rulers of that area.
I've always wondered if George will end this by having like a Romeo and Juliet story between these two houses, but I really don't see how he can do that.
That would be so cute.
Song of Ice and Fire.
Please, no.
Like, so the daughter that he sends, that the one guy sends, like meets the son that the other guy sends, and they like fall in love, and is that what you mean?
And then they die horribly somehow.
Okay, I'm okay with the whole they can fall in love, they can die horribly, they cannot, however, die horribly because they were stupid. And that's my issue with the Romeo and Juliet thing.
Oh, yeah.
Just don't be stupid. That's annoying. It takes out all of the tragedy for me.
Don't get married after 3 days or whatever.
Yeah, also.
And wait for a coroner before you kill yourself.
Definitely.
the epic rap battle of history with Romeo and Juliet is pretty damn funny.
Pina, get us on the rails.
I don't think there's anything in my notes that you guys haven't talked about yet. What do you think about this as the only chapter that we get in Dance? Satisfying?
No, the only one in Dance.
I mean,
the only Jamie chapter. Come on, Brett.
Ends on the cliffhanger.
The only chapter that matters for me in Dark.
Yeah. It's...
How could it be satisfying? I mean, it's necessarily frustrating.
I think it speaks more to the way these two books came together rather than like this book in itself. You know, like the whole splitting it in half thing and all that garbage. It just seems so silly when you look back on it.
I mean, why couldn't he have just put this one in Feast? It just seems silly, really.
Yeah, a bit.
Maybe Brienne wasn't, her story hadn't been told. It was, right?
Yeah,
was
she hasn't Brienne? Got any chapters in Dance.
Yeah, it would be the culmination of both their storylines in Feast. You could almost have it as the last chapter in Feast. That would be a very strong ending.
Yeah.
I almost think George just wanted to leave us with the cliffhanger of Brienne getting hung.
Yeah.
And if he put this in that book, then we would know that, you know,
if it's Brienne.
But
they were supposed to be published a few months apart, right? Even he knew that it wouldn't be the case, or he suspected it might not be, and he was like, let's still put a cliffhanger in this one, just in case.
How would you feel had this chapter been in the last book, and you heard nothing about Jaime and Brienne for this entire book?
I think that's kind of the main issue with it, because you know, the biggest question I would see is, you know, why include this Jaime chapter in here but not include, like, you know, one Sansa chapter as well? I think it comes down to number one that, you know, that Brienne cliffhanger was annoying, although this cliffhanger is even more annoying.
Is it? I don't really know. They seem equal to me.
Well,
it's just to
bring it back, and then just, it's like, yo dog, I heard you like cliffhangers, so I put a cliffhanger inside of your cliffhanger, and that concept of it is just annoying. But I also, I just think it makes it extra annoying. But I think that perhaps that you needed to include the Jaime chapter for both, just because the Brienne one was annoying, and also I think perhaps because you also had Cersei chapters in this book, and you know, Jaime is still somewhat tangentially connected to her storyline, that he needed to pop up too, whereas Sansa's on her own right now and didn't necessarily need a filler chapter that didn't really advance anywhere. But I will agree, like, there's not much of a point to this chapter, whereas, you know, and stuff, and including Arya and Cersei in this book, they both had two really interesting and important scenes that happened in their final chapters.
I'm more cynical. I think George is just a big tease, and so he can say Dance of Dragons is coming out and there'll be Jaime chapters.
I mean, creating cliffhangers is one of his kind of worst traits in writing, because, you know, he did it for a bunch of other, you know, the first three books we just didn't notice because we were reading them all the way through.
I mean, cliffhangers are nice in a TV show when you've got the next episode a week after that, but like when you've got to wait 10 years, they're suddenly not that nice.
Yeah, I mean, when Dickens and all these people who wrote as serial novelists in the Victorian era had a cliffhanger every week, but it was just waiting another week or another quarter for the next edition of your Gentleman's Quarterly or whatever it was that you were reading in. This is just cruel. And I know he didn't intend to be quite this cruel, but it's incredibly cruel. If I mean, 6 years, you get this one chapter, you think, oh, I'm going to be resolved from my cliffhanger. And then literally like 10 pages later, there's another cliffhanger and you're like, Jesus, George. I think it's just mean. I think it's just mean. I have nothing else to say on this chapter. I just think the whole concept of it existing is mean.
At this point, it wouldn't surprise me if the next book has a lot of stuff he writes just to be mean. He hasn't been treated great.
Yeah, I mean, when it comes to how he's been treated, or how he will perceive he's been treated by the fandom, and indeed by Game of Thrones, without spoiling that, just variations relative to his own work, I guess he's probably a fairly rich but bitter man, I would have thought.
I hope the wealth gives him no joy.
No, I hope it gives him joy, because his books have given me joy, but he needs to get on with it. Does anyone have anything else to say about Jaime 1 before we move to the last chapter of the episode?
Two quick things. So number one, even though the cliffhanger sucks, I just really like Jaime's adventures in the Riverlands, you know, kind of this chapter as well as the last, you know, two or three from Feast, and him just settling various things and kind of showing how he's grown and changed, you know, always sending out scouts now, kind of putting into sieges and,
he's not
and
one
doing
of the
these
scouts.
Doing these negotiations and stuff. It's a lot of fun to read. And then the only other thing is there's a fun little quote here when he talks about Arya, where it's just like, you know, hopefully she'll marry some burly blacksmith, aka Gendry, or fat face innkeep, aka Hot Pie. That's just a fun little shout out.
Lovely.
Yeah.
Okay, so after Jaime 1, we jump back 9 chapters, or 140 pages in my edition of Dance, to Aerio 1, /The Watcher, which takes place 5 days later on May 28th and rounds us out for May 300 AL. And it is Matt with the chapter summary. Take it away.
All right. Things were no longer the same in Dorne. Despite the prince's best attempts to stay in family mode, Dorne could no longer keep running away from this war. The royal family has been reunited, and there was much rejoicing. Citizens and readers alike are very excited to finally see some forward momentum in this plotline, as Sunspear lets out a collective exhale. The new White Knight is much more capable than his predecessor, reminding Aerio of himself in his younger days. Their fight would be a true duel of iron. Everyone is suspicious of Skull Gregor's lack of a face, but Tyene has read her father's labels and knows that the poison has done its work. Poor Balin Swan is pretty shook throughout this whole feast. He's wearing full armor in a desert. He's terrible at spycraft and even worse at handling spicy food. Arianne attempts to use seduction, but it's not very effective. After a short children's story, dinner is adjourned. Arianne is now acting like she had Doran's back from day one, and the Sand Snakes are ready to stab immediately, if not soon. Despite Ilaria's protestations, everyone else is in on this together on their eye for an eye cause. Dorne has finally embraced his fire and blood state of mind and has some basic instructions for his squad in order to prepare for the winter wars to come. For Obaro and the Watcher, climb into the night towards High Hermitage, hunt down the renegade Darkstar, and provide some regulation. Nim, kick in the door of King's Landing in the Lion's Den, but don't get hypnotized by the Pit of Snakes. Tyene, walk with the Seven, join with the Revolution, and be prepared for when it goes live. And finally, a dragon is heading to Westeros, and Arianne must needs make positive contact. However, as they reminisce over Quinton, little do they know that a Blackfyre thief has come tonight to try and steal Dany's dream to rule the world. And so, on to Winds and the end of Act 2. Things are falling apart way faster than Dorne can react to. The party has been split in a desperate attempt to search for intel, and we just get to sit back and watch the show. Eventually, hopefully, in like 2 years from now, maybe. And that's it.
Do we think this is Cersei's stupidest scheme yet?
I don't know.
No, he's had far dumber.
I mean, yeah, it might get the job done and Trystane might be killed, but would Doran really believe a bunch of guys shouting half man, half man?
Well, Doran's not getting out of his litter, so I don't think it would matter.
But even if it is successful, like, now you've severed your ties with House Martell.
Yeah.
Like, in the same way that accusing Margaery of incest, adultery, is severing their ties with House Tyrell. It's just, yeah. She won the battle, but is going to lose the war.
Yeah, it's one of the Seven Kingdoms, for fuck's sake.
Yeah. Cersei just doesn't have a lot of forethought in her schemes as far as, like, she thinks about what's going to happen immediately next, but not necessarily what's going to happen, like, five moves down the road. And she's not very good at thinking about what other people might do.
Mm. Yeah, you'd think that this this envoy would be better led by, like, Qyburn or something.
I don't know if it would.
Well,
they might take offense to it, sending a disgraced maester to take their...
He's on the small council.
Yeah.
I mean, Balon Swan.
Yeah, I mean, she probably wanted the honorability of a Kingsguard to, you know, sell that there's no way he could be part of a ruse. Is probably as far as she thought it through. But also, like, Marcella needed a new protector anyway, so.
Yeah.
Well, it kind of gets hijacked and he gets taken off to High Hermitage, right?
Yeah, he will. I mean, obviously.
It hasn't happened yet.
Yeah, they're going to have to. You know, that's just by necessity with the fact that they have to explain how Marcella got hurt, so they need to send him on a quest, and also delays his, you know, their returning, which helps them out.
Throw Darkstar under the bus.
Right, yeah. I mean,
I think Darkstar earned it.
Yeah. He was an easy target. And it's not like they need him for anything else.
So some people think that this skull is one of the dwarf skulls that Cersei has been collecting, and that the real mountain skull is still in the helmet of Franken Gregor.
Yeah,
and like they said in this chapter, like, when another 8-foot knight shows up, how is she going to spin that? And it doesn't seem like they're trying that hard to cover it up.
No, I mean, Kevin knows.
Is it Robert Strong? Yeah, okay. Nobody's ever heard of this 8-foot dude before? I guess so.
Yeah, Randall Tarley knows for sure as well.
Yeah.
But... these guys aren't fooled. But then what, I mean, to be honest, for now, it's only going to benefit them, right? Having like an unstoppable fighter on their side.
Right.
How does,
and I don't...
how does Nymeria react when she gets to King's Landing? And it's like, oh, you're meant to be dead.
Right, yeah. But, like, and it's also weird because, like, you know, I think, you know, I think they would also understand that, like, no, he definitely died. So, like, what? There's no way he could have survived that poison. So, like, how do you, you know, how do you connect those two things in your mind?
I don't think Cersei is scared of the Dornish other than the fact that they have her daughter. I don't know as if she even really cares about them that much.
Right, yeah. I mean, she's probably banking on the fact that, you know, they haven't acted yet in any sort of manner. So, you know, they'll probably just keep doing what they're doing.
Well, it should scare her the most because they're freshest, right?
But they're a defensive-oriented culture, it seems like. Yeah. They just sit back in the mountains and, like, you can't get us, so good luck.
Well, they march, like, Battle of the Red Grass Field and at the Trident. So they do move north in force.
Yeah, but God help, help.
What was that, Jack?
Sorry, Jack.
Everyone Martell killed.
Yeah, I mean, they only do so in very rare circumstances. And, you know, and with what's about to happen, like, she's still not going to be worried about them. Like, you know, they're just kind of, yeah, well, they'll add themselves to the Golden Company's troops, but it's really the, you know, the Golden Company that's the threat within that.
But does she even know about the Golden Company?
No. I mean, not yet. I'm just saying, with, you know, what's going to happen.
I mean, Cersei doesn't even have a very strong small council anymore. I don't even know if she's getting intel on what's happening in other places, or intel.
Yeah, I was just going to say, like, how far is that small council even really functional? I mean, this is not... are they meeting regularly? Does she get proper advice given? I mean, at some point, when you're cut out of decision-making and you're going and your queen is going gonza, you just don't bother, do you?
Well, right now, Cersei's arrested, so I don't think there's a lot of meetings going on.
but that's appalling, right? Now. Because if Cersei's arrested and there's no meetings going on, then what's happened to government? Basically nothing. It's operating in a vacuum.
They called Kevin in and he took over, didn't
right,
he?
Right, that's... Yeah, Kevin and the Tyrells pulled it all together, but then Varys kills Kevin. And so, yeah, it's left to the Tyrells to make the decision of what they're going to do.
Right, because Kevin was pulling it together, he was murdered.
Yeah. But, like, I mean, yeah, but the, I mean, they now, the Tyrell and, like, their Bannermen essentially have de facto power now. Although they'll also have to convince kind of the Lannister troops to fight with them. I mean, that just involves going through Jaime, but, yeah.
Mm.
You think Marcella could be the younger, more beautiful queen, and Cersei's actions trying to get Marcella back could be your downfall?
Marcella's gonna die. She's destined to die. So is Tommen.
Right. The only way out of that is by Cersei, you know, believing and hearing that they died.
And them not actually being dead?
Yeah, that's the only way they get out of it.
Kind of like a Bran Rickon thing?
Yeah.
I don't know, maybe. It sucks because neither one of those characters have ever done anything to offend anyone, so them dying seems like a tragedy, but...
Right, but we also need Cersei to have the full meltdown to complete the great...
She's pretty close to there, man. She's pretty close to there.
Right, but we need the full thing to, you know, see the entertaining death scene and whatnot. Which is why I'm fine if that's what he decides to do is to have her believe that they have died, so we get the full breakdown without the.
I have a feeling it'll be a lot like Joffrey, in that us, like, wanting to see how Cersei, like, wanting to see her demise is gonna get thrown back at us, and we're gonna be like, man, that's not what I wanted.
I mean, I guess, like, I don't know. That's just how I read books. I'm still somewhat at a distance from it. So because I know that it's fiction and fantasy, it doesn't bother me that much.
I know it's fiction, but the little boy that likes to play with cats is going to die for no reason. And you're
I thought you were explaining the, you know, with just the gruesomeness and the way that Joffrey died with, you know, that, and comparing that to the way Cersei is. No, I agree that Tommen and Marcella don't deserve it. And I am dreading, you know,
how that's going
that
come
to
about.
Pass. Yeah, exactly.
So something I want to see in the future is how the High Sparrow reacts to Tyene Sand, the one who's being sent to the Sept of Baelor. In the past, the High Sparrow has, like, he's been able to see through idiots like Osni, Kittleblack, and Cersei, but how this goes down, I really don't know.
Yeah, I don't, like... Yeah, there's no way he would have enough, you know, it would just have to be a cold read. Like, there's no way he would have any pre-existing intel on Tyene.
I could see there being some kind of cold read, like just him knowing that she's like a one of the main families, just by the way she talks and the way she acts, and then her being almost too pure to be there. Like, he seems like he runs like a dirtier sept. I know that sounds weird, but like, just like nothing is as clean.
Right. Yeah, she would definitely have to, she would have to, you know, get rid of any kind of expensive, you know, gowns that she has or whatever. Even though they're all chased in white, she would still need to lessen the quality of the material.
Right. If she shows up in a crisp white gown, I kind of feel like she wouldn't fit in.
Yeah,
and
you're probably
he would know her right away.
Yeah, you're probably right. But like, you know, obviously she's going to recon first.
I hope so.
Yeah. And yeah, and just in terms of, you know, in terms of looks, like, there's no way to tell that she's Dornish. Like,
I don't know. The guy seems like a very good judge of character, so maybe he just...
Yeah, no, it's definitely possible. I'm just saying that it could go, you know, it could go either way, just because it's going to have to be a cold read. Also, how are we going to see, like, how are we going to see that? There's no POV, though. Like, that's tough.
Start getting Lancel POVs.
Because, yeah, she'll just end up being someone in the background of Cersei's POV.
But Cersei's not even there anymore.
Well, she's not in the set, but, like, you know, but she's still in the city, so...
Yeah.
She is being assigned scepters. This is before her trial, so I don't know what will happen afterwards. But yeah, and they keep getting switched out. So I wonder if Tyene will end up right next to Cersei, and she won't suspect a thing.
Yeah, with the switched out part where they're just trying to, you know, give her people that she doesn't know. That could make sense logically, without seeming forced into the story.
Hi.
And it depends on how much that trial is delayed, too.
Because I'm assuming she's not there yet as far as when Cersei does her walk of shame, right? Like, we haven't read that part yet.
Nope. No. But she'll arrive. I'm sure they'll arrive to King's Landing, you know, within the first few hundred pages of Winds.
Do you think she'll travel with them?
Like, with Nymeria and Myrcella?
Yeah, with, like, the whole crew. Or do you think she'll...
I think she'll go separately, so her cover's not blown or anything.
Well, I mean, you could be just a camp follower and not have your cover blown. Like, as long as she's not riding with the royal procession, it'll probably be okay.
Right. I mean, yeah, she just needs to split off before she gets to the city.
Hmm.
Do you think Marcella will spill the beans to Cersei about what actually happened?
I don't think Marcella is surviving to make it to Cersei.
Yeah,
I think she's dying in the ambush.
So what? The ambush will still go ahead even without Baelon Swan?
I think they're going to let men are in place.
I think the Baelon Swan thing will go down, and then they'll head back.
So you think they're going to deliberately try to go in and turn the ambush?
I have a feeling that Nymeria might, like, dye Marcella's hair brown or black so it looks like Trystane, and then through some sort of accident, or maybe intentional accident, something happens to Marcella as, like, payback.
Right. So, like, I can understand, Nym deciding to kill her, you know, during some sort of ambush. I just wouldn't expect Doran to specifically send them through that way.
Yeah.
To try and turn the ambush. And I don't see how Nym could override that order.
Well, it definitely seems like there's... with this whole, like, all the kids look the same thing, it must mean something. Like, they're going to do something with that. So I agree that maybe not dye your hair black, but, you know, everybody, all the kids look the same once they're together. I don't know.
Oh, well, yeah, but that was, you know, at least in this chapter, that's, you know, it's supposed to be more of a thematic and symbolic thing rather than,
is it?
I don't see that as obvious foreshadowing, I guess.
It's a prince's duty to the realm and whether he should call Spears or not because the children suffer and all that.
Marcella's cousin is literally identical to her.
Yeah, didn't they use her as a decoy when they took Marcella away?
Mm. So what, they'd kill Marcella accidentally and deliver the cousin to Cersei?
I'm pretty sure Cersei would know the difference.
Well, yeah, but they wouldn't. And then it would kind of be a fake Arya situation, maybe.
Well, Arya's situation only works because nobody knows what she looks like.
Yeah, but they think they're delivering the Princess Marcella, and then it turns out she's actually dead, and it's some Lannister or Lannisport.
Mm.
I don't know.
Yeah, their goal is to keep Marcella alive, and, you know, only treachery from the Sand Snakes would cause that to occur otherwise.
Or an act of bravery from Marcella, like trying to save Trystane and ends up getting shot by a crossbow or something.
Yeah, interesting. Yeah, that's Right, and that's the other disappointing thing of seeing them die, where it's just, you know, we don't know anything about their characters or anything like that.
Right, we'd have no point of view of those two.
Yeah.
I mean, depending on timing, surely they'll probably get captured by Fagon.
Possibly.
I mean, I don't know if they... I'm trying to bring up, like, a map in my head, I don't know. I feel like Ariane's gonna make it to Fagon first before
I feel just heads back home. For drama, both Nymeria and Tyene have to be in King's Landing as Ariane comes with the Golden Company to King's Landing. Like, if they all get captured by the Golden Company, it's not as good.
Yeah, although that's an end of wins thing. It's gonna take a minute to get to that point.
So Ilaria gives her famous speech.
Yeah, it's a good speech.
So this one resonated. Like, I think sometimes the linear reread throws up contrasts and comparisons in the way the chapters come about. And I thought there was something really nice about in the Jaime chapter where the young bookish boy is talking about the history of the Brackens and the Blackwoods and saying, you know, effectively it's all just ridiculous. You know, there's been disputes for centuries and yet, you know, there's Bracken blood in the Blackwoods and vice versa. You know, it's just this never-ending feud is so futile. And similarly, the speech here by Ilaria, this amazing speech about how, you know, when does revenge come to an end? Does it go to the children and then the grandchildren who must avenge it? And I thought there was something nicely resonant about the way the linear order had thrown these chapters together.
Yeah, it's something that ties better in with kind of some of the other feast chapters, more so than maybe the dance chapters. I think it's another case where you couldn't really include this chapter in Feast because of how good the ending was or how impactful the ending was for the Princess in the Tower chapter.
Yeah. Is there any reason why this shouldn't be an Ariane POV? Is it weird that he tells this chapter from the point of view of the Watcher?
Yeah, that seems odd to me. Like, you know, especially just because, you know, as a character, he doesn't, you know, as you can tell by the discussion we've been having here, you know, we haven't brought him up once because, like, he doesn't matter. He's legitimately just a POV to see other things. And I don't think it's going to...
He's a portrait on the wall looking at everybody.
Right, yeah. He's not, you know, he's not really meant to have a, you know, an arc throughout this story in the way that Ariane is, where, you know, Ariane for me is just the main POV to come out of Dorne.
I don't know what you're talking about, mate. I'm gripped with the backstory. I want to hear more about Norvos.
I don't remember. Does he have a chapter in Winds that we know of?
No.
And
he will, like, he
has
will.
Another. He will. We know
there's
that
nothing
he
released.
Will.
Yeah. Right.
I think maybe just the point is to have one POV with Doran Martell or with whoever stays in Dorn. That's not Arianne because she's going to move away from Dorn. But I'm not sure that it's that interesting. Like,
yep. Well, he's going up to, like, I don't remember where it's been confirmed. I think it's extraneous material. Like, it's either an interview that George said or one of Arianne's preview chapters from Winds, where it confirms that Aerio is going north with Obara and Balin Swan to hunt down Darkstar. So, like, we need his POV for that specifically.
I mean, I don't know if we need it, but that's the point of him and his POV. Because, like, it's going to be nice to see how that plays out, but we could just as easily have heard of it once it's done. We don't necessarily need to see it.
But I think that might be, we want to.
But that's the reason maybe why he's introduced here. It's just because he's going to be useful later to see that Darkstar thing being dealt with.
Yeah, it might just be because, you know, he doesn't have many more Aerio Hotah chapters planned where, you know, he has, like, kind of a full story arc that Ariane is going to go through in Winds. So that just might be why he included Aerio here, just because he's going to have less overall. So he wanted to give him something before he discards him.
Does feel like a waste, though.
Yeah, for sure.
Even if, you know, he will see... And we'll get confirmation that Euron's been warging Darkstar. That is going to be exciting.
That would be something.
I just thought it was a good contrast with Fiona's Leaks chapters, where he's a sort of passive watcher as all these lords are squabbling and bickering and breaking up. So Dorne's sort of reflecting the north, what's going on there.
Very good point.
And I love it with Fobara's whole, like, they're all, like, leading troops and they're all squabbling amongst themselves at the time. Like, yeah, they're doing the same there.
Very good point. Anything else on this chapter from anyone else?
Well, the only interesting thing about Aerio is maybe his prowess as a warrior. Do we think he's a bit of a badass?
He's more of a badass than Dario.
Yeah.
Yeah, when he sleeps with his axe, do you think he ever, like, rolls over and, like, really wrecks himself? Because it's mentioned that he sleeps with his axe.
Yeah, but they train with that. You put, like, dull blades down. You could make it so that you don't.
You train sleeping next to your axe.
Well, I'm just saying, like, no, you can train your body in a way that so you don't move during your sleep.
That seems like a lot of effort. You could just put the axe down by the side of the bed.
Right. Yeah. For sure. No, I agree. But it's just, you know, it's just something that can be done.
Do you think that Gimli sleeps with his axe?
I think Gimli fucks his axe.
Yeah, I think that's more of a caressing, loving relationship.
Yeah, but Gimli can wrap it in his beard. Aerio's probably just covered in scars. All right, confirmed badass then.
And we have nothing else to say.
The way he is referred to makes me think he is a badass. Like, where he's built up.
Yeah, I think he could take Darkstar. And yeah, he's probably on equal footing with Balon Swan too, so...
You reckon? So if he could take Darkstar. I feel like Darkstar is probably a better fighter than Balon Swan. I don't know why, just because the Kingsguard seems so less.
Yeah, but isn't Balon the best?
He's like the exception. Yeah, it's like he's like the exception for me, where I think he's actually capable and like intelligent too. Where you know, Darkstar is certainly talented, but I don't know. But he might be overconfident.
As Balon goes, I'd put him very much as we talk chapter parallels with Sir Uncle. Both trained to watch and observe, both very good, technically proficient, but not one to sort of boast about it overly.
Yeah, the best
of that old vintage version of Kingsguard.
He was one of the leftovers, right?
Yeah, sort of Robert. Genuine service, genuine technical proficiency.
I think Balon was named a Kingsguard after Blackwater.
Yeah, he was appointed in the series proper, but he's like the only appointee that was appointed based on merit rather than some other silly reason.
Yeah,
rather than a chess move.
Yeah,
indeed.
Or or trying to gain the favor of some lord.
Yeah,
that's a chess move.
whatever fucking bet Robert lost the name Boris Blount in this game.
Yeah, what a shit.
You can just imagine him and Thoros drinking or something, and like, if you can't down these 4 yards of ale, you've got to name that fat bloke over there. Do you guys think, again, very few interesting things about Aerio, but do you think maybe in his next POV we'll get to see Dorne or hear a bit more about what's happened to the Dane Blade?
Oh, yeah.
Because he's got to come back into it, right? I mean, it's...
Oh, for sure.
It's such a big deal in the first, like, in Ned chapters. It mentions, like, Arthur Dayne, Dorne, and all that, and the Sword of the Morning.
Yeah, in the same way that probably Blackfyre and Dark Sister have to come back into the story. Like, we need Dawn as well.
Some people mention that the Danes are the biggest casualties of the no 5-year gap. Because some people think Edric Dane, he would
been.
Be 17 if we had 5 more years, which is a perfect age for wielding Dawn and being the next Sword of the Morning.
True. I mean, I think Howl and Reed might have something to say about the biggest casualty of no 5-year break, but... Yeah, possibly. I mean, I don't know, is Edric with Lady Stoneheart now?
He buggered off with some of the other Brotherhood members that are, like, the good ones.
Yeah, there was the split, wasn't there? Who's leading that group?
I can't remember.
Sorry.
I don't know either, man.
Feels like Stoneheart got all the good ones that are still alive anyway.
Right, it's all the ones.
Gendry, Thoros, Lem, Thomas Evans, Angai maybe as well?
No, I think Angai's, because I mean all the named ones I think stayed with Stoneheart, even though Thoros I think is kind of doing it under protest.
Like, right.
He's not in it. He's not you know, crap, the religious, he's not like as much of an extremist or whatever.
He's like that guy at work who comes in, moans every day, and has worked at the company for like 15 years. Just keeps on turning up.
I'm about to say, like, David Tennant and Good Omens, just, you know, kind of got stuck with him when they split.
But Thoros is, like, notoriously bad at his job until the whole breathing of fire thing, right? Breathing life back into Beric.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, that's the thing. He's sticking around because he feels responsible for Stoneheart and leading to her creation. And so
Maybe he's just pissed because she's made him sober up.
I think he's been sober, hasn't he?
Well, I don't know. What chip does he have?
I mean, I think it might be forced sobriety through lack of resources would be the thing.
But yeah, back to the original question. I do think that Aerio is going to be our vector to seeing more of the Danes, you know, not just Darkstar. We might even go to Starfall and have some important revelations happen there.
Hmm. What are you expecting? Yeah,
I don't know, but I just feel like we have to go to Starfall. One small thing is that Ashara Dane might have told Ned where to find Lyanna and Rhaegar at the Tower of Joy.
Okay, yeah, that makes sense.
And how Wyla shenanigans, you know, all that.
if there's a mystery of Ashara that needs to be unraveled, yeah, that's it would do so in that fashion.
What percentage of the mysteries left do you think will be unraveled before the end of the series, if there is an end to the series?
10%.
You think? That low?
I don't know. I mean, I think there's a certain amount of giving you enough, but never giving you the smoking gun.
Yeah, I would have to. We would have to go case by case on that.
Yeah. Right. Like, I think we'll get unequivocal confirmation of R plus L equals J.
Yeah, for sure.
But
do you think Helen Reed will ever grace the page?
Yes.
Do you think we'll ever see Benjen again?
No.
I think yes. There's too many mentions of him.
Yeah, I agree, but how he's been surviving and living, and
if he is alive.
Oh, that would be
But even if he was undead and how he dodged Mance's army, I don't know. It would be ridiculous, but
if I were George, I'd just write him in as like a walker. I wouldn't even like just a zombie. You know, he's dead, guys. He's dead. He's a zombie. He came back to life as a zombie. He's not a good guy.
I hope we don't see him again. I don't think
George has to kill him.
We don't need to see everyone.
Yeah, I don't see a reason to bring him back.
I see that. I think there's also a lot of mysteries because we've made them so by reading and rereading and rereading again and again.
Hey, what are you trying to say?
I don't know.
But you're right. You're so right.
Yeah, that's what I was talking about by case by case, you know, basis or whatever. Just because we've made more mysteries than there need to be.
Yeah, like, sorry, Brett, but we'll have confirmation of the dragons lived on the moon theory.
Yeah.
I don't think we will either, because it's not true.
Right, yeah. Because they were just asteroids. Like,
it is not known.
Okay. Well, I'm going to take this as a sign when we get back to panspermia that we have nothing left to say. Yeah. These chapters.
That's always the way these things end. Moon dragon. Once we get too far down the tinfoil, then we know it's time to stop.
Well, this is a great episode and very insightful and fun. So thank you all for joining. Okay, so the next episode of the Great Linear Song of Ice and Fire reread will cover Tyrion 9, The Griffin Reborn, John Connington 2, and Cersei 1 from Dance. You can follow us, Vassals of Kingsgrave, on Instagram, Facebook, YouTube, Twitter, iTunes, WordPress, by searching for Vassals of Kingsgrave or VOK Podcast. And just another reminder that you can now listen to us on Spotify as well. And if you want to get involved, then please search for a podcast of Ice and Fire and join the forums, where you'll be able to get involved in forthcoming episodes. So with that, it's been great fun. I want to thank Matt, James, Brett, Mary, Michael, Noah, and Jock for joining. And
you are welcome.
Thank you. And with that, I think it's Posse out. Bye, everybody.
Bye.
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 Thank you, Bina.
Thanks,
bye,
Bina.
Guys. Thanks,
bye.
Bina.
Thanks, Bina.
Greetings.
Hey, Sarah, how are you?
Hello.
I'm good. How?
Hey, Adam.
Hi, Adam.
Hey, Patrick.
Yeah.
Hey.
How are you?
Hello, Patrick.
I'm fine and a bit confused. I somehow signed up for something that I...
No, I just called the Vok Reread curator list as a lazy way of contacting Claire and Adam. I didn't realise I was going to disturb you. I'm sorry. But how are you anyway?
I'm fairly okay. How about you guys?
Very good, very good. We just finished reading Feast for Crows in our reread. And we were I know, it's amazing. And we were just kind of discussing the fact that where A Storm of Swords ended, there were so many people who wanted to do the wrap-up episode, and it even, I think, became two parts, didn't it? And there seems to be, like, zero enthusiasm for doing, or not zero, but minimal enthusiasm for doing a Feast recap. And just, it's kind of curious, right? Because it, what does it signal? That people don't love Feast, or they don't think of it as a distinct book? I mean,
I
don't
know. The show's over.
The show's over. But then the reread episodes, like the proper chapter reread episodes, are still getting good interest.
No, the chapter episode that you put up the call to arms for filled out so quickly. Like, people are still interested. It's just not in doing
I think
a wrap up.
I think part of it is, like we said, it's July and there's just so much going on. Like, there's a lot where I'm like, oh, I can't take that on right now.
It's yeah, honestly.
A lot going on in life. And...
Yeah, summer periods are always slow periods.
But definitely, I do think that, like, the end of Feast doesn't feel like an ending for most people. Because you're like, well, no, Dance kind of wraps a lot of that stuff up, too. And we read them together mostly now. And so maybe people are just like, well, I have more to say once we get, like, catch up, once we get to the current point. I feel like Feast is, like, not really there.
No, I was just thinking kind of at the end of Storm, there are so many big, like there's so much, it's so plot rich. And the board game fundamentally changes, like where pieces are at the end of Storm of Swords is so significant. Maybe it prompts debate, whereas at the end of Feast, it's not clear what massively has changed. Although I'm kind of just a bit surprised because there are big characters that we don't see again. Like I thought people would want to talk about Sansa and where Sansa ends up. I mean, I guess there's less interest in where Arianna ends up, but...
and we have those spoiler chapters with her, right? So
yeah, also true.
Yeah.
Like, Patrick, when was the last time you actually... Have you ever read Feast as just a standalone? Or have you always read it as Feast Dance?
It was Feast originally only. I came into it right when Dance came out, like a few weeks after. So Yeah, I read Feast first, and then I was lucky that the Dance came out just next after that.
Yeah.
So I've read them separately, and for me, I mean, yes, I can see the point of reading them together, but I never do, honestly.
Huh? Because I read Feast first originally, because Dance wasn't out yet, but then I've only ever done Feast Dance. So I actually really have trouble separating them in my head.
Yeah,
that might also be a reason why people aren't necessarily interested in just a standalone one, because it's also intrinsically tied now for them.
Yeah, you have to separate them. You have to be careful of... Well, I think you should acknowledge the other book, but try to keep them separated anyways, because it is still... Yeah, like we do in any really reread, you know, acknowledge the books later on, but say that's for the next chapter or for in a year or so.
I think even without the linear reread, like when we would talk about stuff in Feast or talk about stuff in Dance, we'd be like, oh yeah, at the same time, this is happening, you know, over here. Like, you know, that's kind of in the back of your head anyway. So I don't know.
I wonder how George thinks of them. Does he really just think of them as a book that, okay, was published separately, but in his head as one book? Or does he see them as two distinct things? Has he ever spoken about it? Because, you know, like with Tolkien, he's always like very insistent that Lord of the Rings is basically a book in three volumes, but it's a book.
Right.
And I think of it very much as a book, even though I have it in three volumes as well. I wonder what George thinks, though.
Yeah, that's a good question.
Anybody care to take a spin in his body and see?
I wonder if he's ever spoken about it.
Well, Sarah, once Wins comes out, you'll see in the back of the book I've written all about this.
Anyway, dear listeners, so we're not going to do a feast recap separately. We will do a feast dance wrap up, which is the basic point of this conversation, I think. But you said, Adam, on the last reread that you'd recently read Feast and that you really enjoyed it, like surprisingly so, maybe.
Yeah, I mean, I just finished like maybe a month ago. I'm just going to read through it, you know, and while we're the rereading kind of slowed down a little and been keeping up with those chapters as well. But yeah, just to kind of like try to remember what happens where and what order. And it's very interesting, I think, the way that he didn't write it the way that it's published. Like, we know that he was like writing these at the same time, you know, at least in part. And then, you know, it ended up splitting it up. It's kind of an experiment of sorts, I guess. I am kind of curious to hear more from him. I know he's talked about it a little bit, but like what really made him do that? Just because it was kind of something different and new and fun. And I guess when it came out, it certainly was like more experimental. And now it's, you know, people looking back are like, I don't know, like my favorite characters aren't in this book or something, you know, I don't know. I am curious as if it was more like publishing concerns that he decided like these are the stories that he could write like a satisfying volume and put out while still working on the other stories, or if it was just something he thought would work better.
I mean, it's very much a George thing, isn't it? Like, no one in publishing has ever done that. No other writer of fantasy epics has deliberately said, let me tackle one set of locational characters in this book and then do another one the next book. So he's always been unique in that respect, I guess.
Yeah, there's also a bit of like that with the wild cards. They can jump in time or jump in location and then keep to the characters that are in that location specifically. So, and he's, yeah, an editor in that one. So, I mean, I think he might like the idea of separating them by how they interact with each other.
Oh my goodness, Patrick, are you the reader of wild cards? I never met one before.
Well, yeah. superpowers.
You don't need to sound apologetic. I mean, are they good? What are they about? I don't even know what they're about.
Superpowers.
Yeah, well, it's like, sorry for the sound quality right now, but I mean, it's basically like this virus or something, contagion gets released, and like 90% of the populace dies, and the rest either get horrible mutations a lot of them actually survive. Some of them get, most of them get horrible mutations, and the very few called aces get only good powers, and then there are just regular people, but a lot of people die in this contagion, so it's not a good situation for anyone. But then it's like a superhero mutant Chronicle through history beats, like you have the McCarthy and everything like that.
It actually sounds really cool.
So it's like historical fiction, some of it. Okay.
Yeah, sort of like that.
George has always said that, like, you know, like the Wild Cards series, like one of the things that he, you know, never liked about superhero, you know, comics, movies, is that everything's like very idealized, and you know, the guy goes, puts on pajamas and saves the world, and you know, that's not really what would happen if you had powers. And he like kind of likes that it's like, I guess, more grounded. And I mean, but I don't know. I've seen a lot of that with like different superhero worlds or different powered worlds where like people just like, yeah, I can move things with my mind, but I'm an accountant. You know, like it's cool. It's cool. It's interesting, but I don't know.
It's so funny because I always have this like perhaps misperception or prejudice that wild cards is one of the many things that prevents us getting T-WoW. I've developed this irrational prejudice against it. And it actually sounds really cool. So maybe when this reread is over, I should just read me some wild cards.
Heresy, Bina, heresy.
I know.
We should read the first volume together and then like
hashtag Greg is never
upset about it.
He's never going to speak to us again if we start reading wild cards.
Greg will not carry wild cards. Exactly. Until George finishes this series.
Greg will literally refuse to make money selling us wild cards.
It's like, oh, those George R. R. Martin edited books, they won't be in my store.
Thank you, Patrick. You've recommended a new book.
Yeah, this is where image I saved years ago of George posting about people asking him questions in wild cards threads on his blog. You know, the subject is wild cards. Stop asking about Ice and Fire. Right. But that's what people are here for. Like, you know that.
That's what people want. So, like, can you please finish your book series? Thank you.
Yeah, I think I was scarred for anything George R. R. Martin when I chose to read the first Wild Cards book. But Zaytri has something to it, and I like to, especially the character he writes, the great and all-powerful turtle is very illuminating when you think about him saying that that's definitely how he sees himself. So, I could recommend it for the insight into how he views himself.
Huh, okay, interesting. Well, this has been a pleasure, boys and girls. Patrick, you should come on a podcast every now and then. We miss you. It's always a pleasure.
Well, I have been musing about the Targaryen cast, Targaryen talks, so maybe.
Yes,
those are so popular. They're like some of our most listened to podcasts, so I think that would be very, very interesting to listen to.
Especially with Fire and Blood out.
Yeah, exactly. so much more material.
I think we could do an almost like a half summary, half just one more new King episode, combination of that, I think, would do well. But yeah.
Probably.
Maybe. We'll see.
Very cool. Well, don't make promises, because you know what happens as a community when you promise to put out content and then it doesn't come.
Oh, yeah. Really?
This happens.
Okay.
Yeah, there's that full cast recording of Hedge Knight coming out any day now.
Any day? Do you mean like any decade?
So yeah, but anyway.
I mean, I think it's being redone completely.
Like, if it comes out next year, it is in a new decade.
Yeah. See you guys.
Bye, Patrick.
Bye, Patrick. Bye. And I guess we can wrap this up too, Adam, Sarah. Just, I thought, good to let the listener know what's going on and why there isn't the Feast recap episode. So thanks for jumping on.
Yep, some stuff happened. Characters were missing. You know, the book was read.
Life happened. Shit happened. Summer occurred.